Hello, and welcome to the Local Brown Bagger, your source for Canadian speeches, right here on CFRO 102.7 FM, your co-op radio station in Vancouver. Today we ask, were the first peoples of BC really just hunters and gatherers, or did they farm the sea as well? Judith Williams, author of several books about the BC coast, introduces her new book, Clam Gardens, on February the 13th, 2007. The speech was recorded by Thomas Hicks of Necessary Voices Society. We take you to the Vancouver Public Library for the introduction. You are listening to the British Columbia author and investigator Judith Williams describing the evidence for clam gardens kept by the Aboriginal people of the West Coast. She was speaking in February 2007. This is CFRO Co-op Radio, 102.7 FM in Vancouver, the Local Brown Bagger Show.
Since 1989, she has traveled extensively up and down BC's west coast on board her two boats, Tatiscus and Adriatic Sea. She chronicled her voyages of discovery in a series of books, High Slack, Waddington's Gold Road, and the Butte Inlet Massacre of 1864. The next book, Two Wolves at the Dawn of Time, Kingham Inlet Pictographs, 1893 to 1998. And one of the more recent ones, Dynamite Stories. She has summered in Desolation Sound since 1972. In her more recent book, which she's here to present tonight, Clam Gardens, her research challenges the notion of pre-contact West Coast Indigenous peoples as hunter-gatherers alone. In presenting evidence that the rock structures seen only at lowest tides were used by Native people for the purposes of cultivating clams. And she'll have a lot more to say on that, I'm sure. Would you please bring Judith Williams a warm welcome?
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you for coming to hear about the Clam Gardens. And I know that some of you were already here to hear Nancy Turner talk about cultivation of native plants. And these two things are quite related. Now, I wanted to make clear to everybody that the clam that I'm going to speak about mainly is this one, which is a butter clam. A lot of people think I'm talking about the small Manila clams and little neck clams. Well, Manilas didn't exist here until the 1920s, and the little necks probably weren't worth building these enormous structures for. So it's this clam that I'm going to talk about. Now, the interesting thing about the clam gardens is that they look to be mariculture as practiced by Native people, probably for thousands of years on this coast. And I'd like to read you a story, sometimes called a myth, which talks about the clam gardens in a different way. And then I want to talk about how truthful this particular myth is. It's a story from the Tlawitsis people of Turner Island in Beware Pass, and that's located somewhere near the outer mouth of Night Inlet. So here's the story. Head Wolf and those who had him for their chief lived at Ebb Tide Beach, south of Crooked Beach. Born to be the son, Mink, lived at Crooked Beach. The people of Head Wolf were always happy, because they had many kinds of shellfish to eat, for the tide always went down to their beach. The tide did not go down on Crooked Beach, and those who lived at Crooked Beach were always hungry. Born to be the son always felt badly. He lay on his back in his house to think what to do. When night came, Born to be the son made himself small. He stole Head Wolf's son from his house and returned to Crooked Beach. When Head Wolf discovered his child was gone, he got into his canoe with his speaker and came to Crooked Beach searching for his son. Born to be the son's mother went out of her house, and she called to Head Wolf to make the tide go down to the shellfish, and his son, she said, would be returned. Wolf's speaker called out, "Bring the child, and the tide shall go down to the barnacles. Born to be the sun's mother asked, what good are the barnacles? The old man spoke again, it shall go down to the seaweed. Of what use is seaweed to us? Then Headwell's speaker spoke again, bring the son of our chief, and the sea shall dry up everywhere. That is too much, born to be the sun's mother said. You have done too much. Why is it not enough to wish that it may go down to the rolling stones? The speaker called out, bring the son of our chief. The ebb tide will not pass the rolling stones. Thus, born to be the sun obtained the tides of our sea. Now all the myth people were rich, for they ate clams and all kinds of shellfish. Now this Tlawitsa's story I found in Quacutal Text by Fran Boas and George Hunt. George Hunt was what is often called an informant, a term I don't really like, for Franz Boas and supplied him with a lot of his material. And George Hunt lived at Fort Rupert. He was the son of First Nations mother and a Scottish father. Now, the village that they're talking about, Crooked Beach, is actually a translation of the name of the village where the Tlawitsa's people come from, and it's called Carlaquiz. And so Crooked Beach is an actual translation of that name that's still used to this day. One of the interesting things is that the location of Ebbtide Beach is simply south and east of Carlaquiz. So these places exist. In fact, Ebbtide is actually on one of the charts, marine charts. And so the story that I've read to you is a piece of oral history, right, which tells us some actual factual material. And it's a very interesting way of passing down material in a society where you do not write. So this is oral history. And it's a favorite story of mine since it talks about the necessity, right, for the tide to go down to the rolling stones. And the crucial thing about butter clams and the clam gardens is that you can only see them at the lowest of the low tides. And so that's what Mink is asking for, is that the tide go down to that space. Now, I'm going to also talk a little bit about mapping and where these things are. And so I put, rather crudely, a map up on the board here, and I'm sorry it's so far from you, but I'll point out a few things. It is the map that I used when I was writing the book. And on that long map, I had a series of colored pins to notate clam gardens as I found them, or as they were told to me. And this sequence of indigenous clam garden locations began at Orcas Island, down in the San Juans, down here. There actually is a story written by an anthropologist of a clam garden there, and he says it is unique. It hasn't been found so far, but that doesn't mean it won't be found. But the location is known. The pins extended up to Quadra Island, into Loughborough Inlet, north to the Kwakwaka'wakw Islands, west of the mouth of Knight and Kinkam Inlets. The pins skipped up to the Heiltsuk territory around Bella Bella, and they ended near Sitka, Alaska, where Dr. John Harper saw clam gardens from a helicopter in 2005. The red dots pinpointed clam gardens that I've investigated personally. Yellow indicated those located by Dr. John Harper from the air. And the white dots marked sites identified by Native people, like particular small spots in Johnson Strait near Port Neville, where there is a name that refers to stone walls put up on the side of the beach. That's actually the name of that little bay. This map evolved since 1993, and from correspondence that noted between explorers' description, Native stories, features of land, and piles of stones. The stones piles were not newly stacked, and they were not natural. And when it was discovered what these were, it cracked open a trail to the past, and it overturned accepted concepts of Native food systems and economics. And it's certainly one of the most exciting puzzles that I ever encountered on the coast, and I really enjoy puzzles. And so this vast sweep of clam gardens up this entire territory from here off the top of the map into Alaska, but concentrating in this area and in this area. That's what we know the most about at this time, but that is not the only location of clam gardens. Now, when I was working on this book, or when we were traveling looking at things, people would say, what is a clam garden? It just didn't make sense to most people, the name at all. But I actually got the name from a man named Billy Proctor, who spent his entire life in the Broughton Archipelago, where there are hundreds and hundreds of clam gardens. And he built his own clam garden over a 40-year period. And Billy is probably the most knowledgeable person around about the actual structuring of a clam garden, how you start from zero and produce a lot of clams. And this is what Billy wrote. He said that native people had taught him that a clam garden was a clam beach that was tended with great care and a lot of work. Rocks were gathered up from the sandy beach area and piled in a ring along the low tide perimeter. The removal of the rocks made more room for the clams, and the wall of stones prevented the sandy beach from slowly eroding. So the beach that we're talking about looks like this. Usually there's bedrock at both ends, not always, but mostly, and that stabilizes the wall. So if you're going to build a stone wall, you need something to attach it to. So usually it's attached to bedrock on both ends. This is the pile of stones, right? And this is the flat where the clams grow. Here, very often, is a canoe slide where you can bring a boat very easily into the clam garden. Now, this diagram is based on a small garden on Monday Island up in the Broughton Archipelago, and you'll find in the book a picture of my boat, aluminum boat, Tetakis, slid into the canoe slide. So all of that is still intact in that particular garden, simply unchanged over a vast period of time. Now, what were they doing in trying to build that wall? They were taking what is a normal sloped beach, and they're raising it up. And one of the things about clam gardens is they're remarkably flat. So if you hit a part of the coast that is conveniently and very nicely very flat out from the shore, have a look around at the low tide and see if there's a rock wall at the outer side. It may be a clam garden. So the structure is very straightforward, and once you get a look at one, it seems pretty obvious that the beach has had these stones piled in a particular kind of way. Now, I became fascinated by these structures in 1993, after I was sent to see clam garden structures on Quadra Island by Clahoos elder Elizabeth Harry, known as Kikus. And that visit led me to the proposition that these clam gardens and similar structures that I began to pinpoint on this map were created when indigenous people seeking to maximize clam production for an expanding population rolled boulders to the extreme sea edge of a butter clam bearing location to create a ridge parallel to the shore. So what you have there is a very deliberate action, it seems to me, in order to maximize the growth of the clams. Now, a parallel investigation began in 1995 when marine geomorphologist Dr. John Harper was mapping the British Columbia coastal areas from a helicopter for the provincial government. In order to do that, you must fly along the outer edge of the shore at the lowest of the low tides in order to actually map the shore. And that's what he was doing. So he was ideally placed to see anything that was at the lowest tide. And when John was flying over the Broughton Archipelago islands, there's a great number of them, he saw kilometers of what he thought must be human-made rock walls, and he was extremely surprised to see what he thought were artificial constructions. Eventually, after some research, John became convinced that Native people had not only dug natural clam habitat, but in favorable locations around the Broughtons had erected a complex of rock wall terraces that suggests what we call mariculture. Bringing these Native Mariculture structures to light may be termed by some a discovery, although the clam gardens, as I show in the book, were never lost. And given the evidence of Native knowledge and usage that has come to light from 1993 on, it's prudent to sidestep that term, discovery. Let's just say that the story of the reemergence of these rock structures makes visible to the non-Native world a mindset-altering number of boulder walls, which were erected by Northwest Coast Indigenous people at the lowest level of the tide. The number of the gardens, their long usage, and the labor involved in rock wall construction indicate that individual and clustered clam gardens were one of the foundation blocks of Native economy for specific coastal people. That is actually, from an anthropological and archaeological point of view, quite a radical statement, since most people assume and certainly repeat that the basis of a Native economy was salmon. And that certainly was very important. But there are certain areas on the coast where huge salmon rivers do not run. And people had to find other foods. And the Broughton Archipelago, by the way, is one of those areas. Even though there are massive salmon runs at the head of Kingcome and Knight Inlet, around Guilford Island, where the people live there, there are no major salmon runs. Now, as in all good stories, and I think the Clam Garden story, as it unfolded, and that is actually what I'm telling in the book, is the story of the unfolding of the Clam Gardens story. As in all good stories, acutely differing angles of observation add a certain tension to the tale. This one circles warily around the perplexing absence of textual reference to these major food-gathering sites in both biological and archaeological reports, and the bemusing indifference of contemporary archaeologists to my initial reports of the garden's existence, as well to Harper's science-backed efforts to gain their attention. But far from notating just the location of rock terraces built to cook clams, the story of clam gardens is a disclosure that wanders into connections between landforms, food, territory control, and claims about rights, ownerships, gender authorship, and the authority to speak about such matters. It places a high value on local knowledge that revealed them to my consideration. Now, this is a new story. It's only in the last about 3 or 4 years that the social scientists have actually accepted that these things exist. And so it's naturally rife with speculation, both on my part, on the part of John Harper, and a small group of other people who simply started guessing. But as you'll see, I actually wasn't guessing. I simply was told something. But new data emerges sporadically from both Native and non-Native sources. I'm constantly having things pointed out to me. I talk to Native people. They tell me about other clam gardens or possible clam gardens, or they ask about clam gardens. And if you go on the net, you'll find that almost all the tribal groups along the coast now are integrating clam gardens into their land claims. But what I think is that if the clam gardens are truly accepted as essential cultivated units of Native economy, a term like hunter-gatherer, which I always found rather insulting, and which has been used by social scientists to define Northwest Coast Native society, must simply be reassessed. The convenient conviction that explorers and settlers were entering unowned virgin wilderness will evaporate. For me, there is also a deeply affecting aesthetic and ecological lesson in the stretches of carefully constructed rock walls in Wyatt Bay. And that's where I first saw the clam gardens. There, need was so harmoniously mated to sight, and a solution to the problem of increasing food supplies so elegantly resolved, that the rock wall terraces were assumed to be natural formations and simply ignored in the archaeological site reports. And that's an interesting thing, that they simply weren't found.
You are listening to the British Columbia author and investigator Judith Williams describing the evidence for clam gardens kept by the Aboriginal people of the West Coast. She was speaking in February 2007. This is CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, the local brown bagger show.
Now, unlike John Harper, who was very clever in seeing from the air that something was not natural, I was told what clam gardens were and where they were. And that was a result of work that I was doing in 1992-93 on a book, an exhibition called High Slack that I was doing at the Museum of Anthropology. And in order to answer some questions, I contacted a woman named Elizabeth Harry at Sliammon Village, which is just north of Powell River. And after we'd worked together a little bit and had a few conversations, one day I'd asked about food, I think, or something related to that, and she very firmly suggested that I take our boat north through the rapids to Quadra Island and look at the walls that her people had long ago erected around Wyatt Bay. So I'll show you where this is. Some of you may very well be aware of this territory, but I was coming from Refuge Cove, where I spend my summers in here, and she was telling me to go up here. So there's not a huge distance, so she thought that was easy to do in the boat, and it proved a reasonable trip. However, you have to go through some rapids to get into this particular bay here. And it's interesting that the bay opposite, there's just a very narrow neck that leads you into a whole other territory. And that has something to do with why people would bother to build these large constructions in that particular spot. There's a number of factors involved. Now, one thing that Kikas warned me is that I would have to go at a zero tide. And if you're not used to having a tide book in your hand when you go out in your boat, you may not be so conversant with this. And I, at the time, was not so sure that I had to hit the zero tide, even though that's what she told me. And so I went off on a day that had a very low tide, although not quite a zero tide. And it was the end of August when the low tides are starting not to be so low. So most of the low tides in the daytime occur in the months of May, June, July. And there's some good ones, pretty good ones, in August, although not usually zero tide. The rest of the low tides occur in the middle of the night in the dead of winter. So if you want to go clam digging right now in February, which is quite a good time to dig for butter clams, you will be going out in the dark. And this is interesting because these clam gardens were built to be harvested in the winter, therefore in the dark, which I think is very interesting kind of farming, you know, to have to do. So I set out in that August morning with my friend Corinne Corey in my aluminum speedboat, and powerful affair, and had been particularly built for exploration. You could walk off the front and whatnot. It's a very nice boat. And I headed up Lewis Channel and crossed Calm Channel, and then I had to go through White Rock Pass and through certain narrow rapids in order to get into this particular bay, and I hadn't actually ever done that by myself. But I had to go past Tatapuis, which is an abandoned village at White Rock Pass. And this village, if you read the book, you'll find how crucial it was in the politics of Native moving around after white people came here. And so the village was very carefully placed, and it's a really good spot for growing clams in there in itself, and it's close to this Wyatt Bay area. And I think it was part of this food complex. Now, there's rocks everywhere in this area, and at the extreme tides, which are the high and the low tides that you actually want, there can be the tides can run 12 knots at the flood through this area. So there's a lot of intense movement, and this surge narrows, I think, is part of the reason the clams grow so well, because water pulses back and forth through this area, very strong currents. And I've come to think that the conditions have to be ideal for the effort to build these complexes of walls. Not every place has as large a group as Wyatt Bay, which has over 40 individual clam gardens. Now, once we got into Wyatt Bay, there's a narrow entrance back in front to the bay. I wasn't quite sure what to look for because Kikas hadn't been that specific about where the gardens were, so I just simply headed for a likely-looking spot where I wouldn't ground my boat. And I did discover eventually that most of the clam gardens were flat. There was a rock wall, and then there was a drop, and you could bring a boat very nicely in there. and there would be a drop of 4 or 5 feet of water even at the lowest tides. And so we got off, my friend and I, and started looking at this flat thing that was extending from the boat, and I thought, well, this must be what she means. There's a rock wall, there's a flat area, there's evidence of clams, lots of decayed shell, everything's there, so I assumed that what I was looking at was what Kikas had told me. And one of the things that was very interesting was that as we strolled the spouting, oozing, sucking terrace, it seemed a live thing. As if in construction, the builders were able to enhance the life of an existing locust. Not by replanting each year, but as the West Coast natives did when digging clover roots in the deltas of the long inlets, by reburying new growth into a habitat enhanced through the repeated cultivation resulting from harvesting. So you're moving the soil. Making things better for the next time, removing stones, as my friends who are clam diggers say that they do automatically anyway, just simply, you know, getting rid of stuff that's going to be a nuisance. And I assume is the bedrock of all husbandry. Enhancing what's there, increasing its density and size, but working with what wanted to grow there, what the terrain suggested or even insisted. So what I think is that the clam gardens are built where this is a very likely situation and clams themselves actually are there, and they simply enhance and increase by quite a bit the size of these beds. So while we were there, we were looking at this place, and the walls seemed very elegant as it sort of, you know, followed the land in this sinuous manner. And I thought, maybe this is hundreds of years of enhancement. And that was, of course, a very, that was too short a time, I was guessing. But one thing I was sure of was that I was standing on an ancient living entity, right, that could be destroyed in minutes by thoughtless bulldozing. Gone. And lots of them are gone where logging has happened and the walls have been broken down, things like that. I've lately come to call them living artifacts. And I don't know how that goes down, but it seems to me that's a way of saying this is something to be preserved and prized, but is an alive thing. It's not like a stone sculpture. It's not even like a petroglyph, although some people might argue about that, but it's alive. And we looked around the rest of the bay, but the tide came up, and we couldn't see any more walls. And one of the interesting things is when the tide comes right in over the walls, it's almost like you were hallucinating. That you think, did I see that? Is it really there? And the next day I phoned Kikas, and I said what I had seen. And she said, no, you didn't see them all. They're all around the bay. And that proved to be true. So this entire bay was ringed by clam gardens, and it took a number of years before I saw most of them. Now, I was left with a lot of questions because I am an artist and a writer. I'm not an archaeologist or an anthropologist, but I did know that if I wanted more information or if I wanted to report something I'd found, I called the archaeology branch of the BC Heritage Conservation Department in Victoria and said, this is what I've seen. What other information have you got? Have you got site reports? I want to know more about this thing that I've seen. This woman has told me, this Native woman has told me about them. I really want to find out more. And they said no. They had recently surveyed Wyatt Bay, and they had the site reports to prove it, and no such walls had been found. There was nothing in the literature to indicate indigenous mollusk mariculture. And if indigenous rock construction existed, it was a salmon trap. Kikas' information simply was put aside. Now, I was kind of miffed by this response because it seemed like they weren't even remotely interested, even if I had discovered something. And my husband, who's a soccer player, called one of his soccer buddies, whose family had lived at New Church House, which was in recent times the closest occupied village to Wyatt Bay. That church house is on the mainland side, but it's no great distance. And the people lived there for a long, long period of time up until, I think, the late 50s or early 60s. Wyatt? Oh, yeah, Calvin said, that's where we go for clams. So this time I had two people who authenticated that clams could be dug there. And I had Kikas's information. Now, I was to learn subsequently that she came from a very knowledgeable family. She was well-respected as a genealogist amongst the Native community. And she was somebody who to trust in this kind of information. And I later discovered there was a lot of information from her mother, Rose Mitchell, and that this family was very knowledgeable and used these clam gardens probably well up into the late 60s. Now, I continued to visit Wyatt Bay with my husband, Boba Fraser, and in our boat, and we took various people also to the clam gardens to show them these very beautiful things and also to try and take people who might validate what I had seen there. And then in 1997, I'd written one report to the archaeology office at this point about what I'd seen, but I wrote a long, long letter detailing what I'd seen, and also the fact that there was some damage happening from logging in Wyatt Bay on one of the clam gardens, in fact, the first one that I had seen. That they carefully filed this in their files, but they never responded in any kind of way to my offer to take them there. We continued to visit these places. And during that time, we bought a large seine boat, during visits up into the Broughton Archipelago with that boat, which we were able to take into that area, I had noticed something that resembled a clam garden up there. And in the summer of 2003, we docked the Seiner, the Adriatic Sea, at Echo Bay on Guilford Island in the Broughton Archipelago. And since there was a very low tide the next day, we went around in the small boat to look at this thing that I had seen, which was in the neck of Shoal Harbor on Guilford Island. And directly opposite this place lives Billy Proctor. And so we went over and I asked Billy if those, what I was looking at there, had been built for raising clams. And he said, yes, those are clam gardens. And there are lots more in this territory, in the Broughton. And he said, I'm just writing about them in my book. He said, Native people built them for clams, and over there in the neck in the spring, they hung hemlock boughs on the clam garden walls and herded herring in with boughs hanging down from the canoe slides. It caused the herring to spawn on the boughs on the walls. So this is a multiple-use situation. So the clams grew there, but they also used it for getting the herring eggs. Now, it was Billy's understanding, and this is how he explained it to me, that the clam beds nearest a village belonged to a dominant family, and families of lesser rank had to enhance remoter beds to ensure clam supply. Butter clams grown in the gardens were, he said, either eaten roasted in their shells at the edge of the fire or braided into chains, smoked, and stored. And he knew exactly how to do all this, and he had built his garden over a 40-year period, and he had dug butter clams so assiduously that he paid for a huge hunk of land that he owns up in that territory. So it was very productive of cash for he and his wife. And he said that there were more clam gardens in the Broughton than anywhere on the coast, and that may very well be true. There's simply hundreds and hundreds of them there. And he said they're very easy to locate at low tide. Look for a wall of neatly piled stones fronting a small beach, and you found a clam garden. And he mentions also the canoe slide. And so that was an indication that what I had been looking at down in Wyatt Bay also occurred in other places at the coast. And that was the first point where I saw that there was an extension of this technology, which I've come to call it. Now, the clam that we're talking about is this butter clam. And there are other things that grow in, this is a forkful from a clam garden. So this is what I've got. I've got a cockle, I've got horse clam, little neck, butter clam. So all those things grew in the substrate there at different levels, right? So you could dig all of them up at one spot in a clam garden. Now, when Kika sent me to Wyatt Bay, and I really like this because it turns up later, she said the clam breads there produce the best butter clams on the coast. That is, the best ones grew. And this is kind of a fine distinction. It's kind of, this tastes better, it is a better clam, etc. And it became obvious that Wyatt Bay was full of these clam gardens, but also there were villages there, and there was a lot of midden everywhere. And most of the midden that we see on the coast essentially is made up of butter clam and other fine grain material. You will find also the bigger horse clam shells in the midden as well, because they were important. You also find layers of purple hash. And clam hash is kind of a term for this substrate where the clams like to grow. And sometimes you see a strip of purple, and it's muscle, of course. And up in the Broughton, one of the things that's interesting and may help people actually date the Broughton Gardens is that there's muscle up to a certain point, rather dense, and then there's butter clam hash from there up. And they do think that that interface may indicate a point in which the clam garden technology kind of exploded. But that's just a hazard. But I think that you'll find that Dr. Harper and Dr. Don Mitchell, who's an archaeologist, will probably come up with material like that fairly soon. But you know, it takes some science to do that. Now, Native people valued the butter clam, which produced a larger and tastier amount of meat than Native little necks. So the little clams that we buy to steam open are usually Manila clams and little neck clams. And but that wasn't what they were after. The butter clams had just a massive amount of meat inside, and it was easy to string them on ironwood sticks to smoke them, dry them, string them on cedar strands, and store them and trade them. And so like salmon, this was something that you could exchange with other people. You could transport it. You could keep it. And so it's a very crucial kind of food. And so it made sense to build these clam beds in places where maybe you didn't have so much other food. Now, the structures also produced these horse clams, which are good size, and they were very important to the economy as well. And they were harvested in the summer, unlike butter clams, which were essentially harvested in the winter. And the horse clams could be dried also and skewered on waxberry stems, and they could be stored as well. And their shells were very, very useful for serving containers and as dippers for skimming ulekan oil. And they were also sharpened to make knives. So I found some few little stories of people. The women are... I did forget to mention this at the beginning. The clam guards were essentially operated by women. And so what stories we basically have is women going out and using the gardens and making knives out of the shells and smoking and drying, things like that. Now, people often say, how old are they? Well, I don't know. What we can do is go back to when clams first were available on the coast, and we're talking, 10,000 years ago in Hecate Strait. There are records of clams being there, and but that doesn't mean that people were using the clams at that time. However, I just want to point out that archaeological digs at Namu, on the mainland east of the northern tip of Vancouver Island, and in the Barry Island midden, just southwest of the Broughton, indicate that people in both locations live over 9,000 years. And we know that at Namu, the bottom of the midden, they're eating basically almost an Inuit diet with sea mammals and things like that. And then there's more and more salmon and clams and things like that in the midden. So the diet did change over this period of time.
You are listening to the British Columbia author and investigator Judith Williams describing the evidence for clam gardens kept by the Aboriginal people of the West Coast. She was speaking in February 2007. This is CFRO Co-op Radio, 102.7 FM in Vancouver, the local brown bagger show.
Now, it's hard to get butter clam. When I had my book launch, I actually made butter clam chowder, and I had to really scrounge around to get them. But I have bought them from Native friends, and may charter with those. But one of the problems, the reason you don't see them, is that they butter clams grow 25 to 30 centimeters below the surface in the lower third of the tidal zone. So we're talking, not only are they lowest tide, but they like to be deep in the thing, and not like the manillas and other clams. So they're not handy. Another reason you don't see them for sale is they don't close tightly. So that they don't close tight like this so that the meat is protected for transport. They gape a little bit, so that gives them a shorter shelf life, and they tend to freeze them in their shells in order to transport them these days because they don't like to stay shut, nor do horse clams, so we almost never see horse clams for sale. Now, a lot of my information about the biology connected with butter clams came from a man named Neil Bourne, and there's a wonderful little booklet called The Clam Fisheries of British Columbia, published in the 70s, when the Pacific Biological Station in Nanaimo was doing a lot of work on butter clams, Neil Bourne particularly, in order to see if the economy could be upped in the selling of cultivating and selling of butter clams. And so he talks extensively about butter clams. And one of the interesting things about he and Dan Quayle, who did all the work, is they never saw the walls of the clam gardens. They're still a bit skeptical. But nonetheless, we're very, very helpful. And you'll find in the book a kind of an extensive preamble about clams. And one of the things that Bourne noted was that butter clams like to grow near boulders because the eddies around the boulders raise the water temperatures. So these clam gardens, I was always a bit surprised because the surface, although flat, sometimes there were protruding boulders. But it turns out that that's a good thing. And he said that a Japanese mariculturist sink large cement boulders, which they cover with brush in order to increase temperature and spat retention in clam cultivation. So in Japan, they do this. We're not doing this because we just have clams growing everywhere. We just didn't realize that other people had maybe improved their situation. And this is kind of interesting because in an email that I received from a man named Tom Seawood, who's a native man from up in the Broughton kind of area, and this is his speculation about clam garden development. Butter clams like to hide around big boulders. We clam diggers know this. So after moving some rocks to facilitate beaching canoes, that is to make a canoe slide, the beach may have some clams, that is the clams may grow. After working the beach, my ancestors would have noticed what we call a fluffy beach because of the touch of man. My ancestor says, we've made a productive beach because of working it. It would become their property. They'd guard it with their lives because in a still harsh climate, clams would mean the difference between life and death. And that's very interesting because when you go and look at a clam garden and you dig in it, it's fluffy where it's been continually used. There's a lightness to this clam hash. It's quite unique, and it does degenerate if it's not used. That's one of the interesting things is if a clam garden is not used, it tends to silt up and compact. But where clam diggers are still using it, it has this fluffy, light quality. So I was very interested that Tom came up with this fluffy. Nobody else has used this term except him, so I have to attribute it to him. So even though we don't know exactly when they would have started building these things, it does seem that in the use of the territory that they're in order to get canoes in and out, they had to move rocks, they had to move boulders, and canoe slides are a feature of all village sites, and you can still find them. And also, if you're going to build a salmon trap, which is what the archaeologists insisted these were, you have to build these stone loops at the mouth of the salmon streams. What's interesting, I've never seen a wall, a complete wall, like you see in a clam garden built where there's a salmon stream. So that there seem to be two distinct stone kinds of structures. And there are salmon traps, and I think that there may be some inadvertent seeding as well, because butter clam shells like these were used to line some of the salmon traps in order for them to be white and reflect the light. And so you can imagine there would be bits of clam and maybe spat. So there could have been this seeding. So these things may have, you know, crossed. There's certainly a possibility. Now, what was perplexing after coming up with all this information is that no clam researcher or anthropologist or archaeologist appears to have seen or considered important the Wyatt clam terraces or the more than 350 sites that Dr. John Harper calculated he found in the Broughton. Dr. Dom Mitchell's Quadra and Broughton Archipelago site reports from the 60s note village sites, fish traps, and rock art, and they detail midden dimensions. But nowhere does he indicate that he knew of the clam gardens. Aside from Harper's and my reports, no site report or book acknowledges them until a cautious note is appended to archaeologist Don Abbott's June 7th, 2001 site reports, in which he says that there are fish traps in Wyatt Bay. And then there's a little note saying, it's possible they may be for the recruitment of clams. That's it. Okay, so that's 2004. Be very careful. Now, I don't want to disparage Don Mitchell's work because it's fabulous. You know, I've just endlessly seen these wonderful site reports. And he had the grace to acknowledge that he had probably seen the walls and he just didn't figure out what they were. And since nobody else was talking about them, they just simply didn't kind of register. But his work there is remarkable. Now, this silence is interesting, given that there existed from the 1920s right into the 1980s an active commercial market for butter clams. Many native people were involved in digging, transporting, and processing clams for this market. And as late as 1980, government statistics indicate butter clams were BC's major bivalve export. So you thought somebody might have asked where they all came from. Now, butter clams were dug during that time, during the 2 weeks of lows per month from November through January and February, when the tide bottoms out to their level. Economist, author, and fisherman Dr. Don Pepper told me that during the 1940s and 50s, clam digging was so economically important, a clam digger's calendar was published. Don said that when he dug clams in the 50s, he did this to put himself through university, just to point that out, the drill was to approach Dong Chong, the pioneering store owner in Alert Bay, and get fronted $30 worth of bacon, coffee, beans, and eggs. He had to pack this stuff into a sturdy boat alongside the bucket, sacks, digging forks, and the essential rain gear. The diggers worked the first available low tide and returned the next night for the next and lower tide, working the beach or a series of beaches down to the zero low tide and then back up as the tides became less extreme. So they would have a period there kind of where they could work down and then back up, and then that was it. From the Department of Fisheries Area 12, the northern Johnson Strait territory that includes the Broughtons, diggers headed back to Alert Bay to sell clams to buyers such as William Scow, who worked for BC Packers. William Scow lived in the native village at Guilford Island, Guisdoms, and he was an employee working on contract for BC Packers. And Don remembers all this very well, and he recalls that Scow packed Broughton area butters on a barge pulled by the Saner BC Packers number 11. And he pulled those clams as far south as the Imperial Cannery in Steveston and to Everett, Washington, from the 1930s onward. When he was succeeded in this enterprise by Harry Stauffer, in the 1960, Don Pepper's current boat partner, Byron White, transported butters for Comato, and that was one of the markets for it. The clam body was sold for clam meat, and the liquor became the clam part of Clamato juice. Sometimes in the 1970s, I'm sorry to tell you, it was replaced by a synthetic flavor, so consume it at your risk. Now, I was given by a man named Bear Scow, who's the a grand nephew of William Scow, and by Judge Alfred Scow, who's William Scow's son. Some audio tapes were made by the Seattle Art Gallery, and I'm very fond of this transcript of William Scow talking. "I'm a clam man," is how he announces himself. "In my job, I used to work with a biologist when they wanted to determine how long the clams would survive with all the digging we were doing. Billy says the way they're digging, they can last for another 20 years without depleting." That wasn't so long. "I gave him all the Indian names for the spots where they dug because there's just crevices here and there, and all those places have Indian names. And I told him the Indians believe there's some high-level clams, not right down. When you go clam digging, you think you need a big tide. You don't have to. One half tide. You want a bigger tide so you can dig longer. And I told him the Indians believe ducks, when they feed on clams, they drop some on the high-level crevices, and that's why they grow there." William also pointed out that his Gwaisdom village, this is on Guilford Island, was on top of a layer of butter clam shell that went right down to the bedrock. Hardly any dirt. That's all they lived on was clams. "We had the best butter clams on the whole coast at Guilford." Scow's claim that they lived on clams makes sense of a taunt directed from an exclusively salmon-eating member of the Nimkish tribe to a Guilford boy, that green stuff like that in a clam intestine grew on his belly. So it's quite an insult to him. And that is in Boaz, but Boaz still doesn't say anything about why they would bother to say such a thing. And yet William Scow is saying that a big part of their diet was clams. Now, William himself describes clam propagation around Guilford that he observed. "They spawn in the spring of the year on top of the soil," he means the sand, "and the tide brings them up, and then they drift with the tide. And in 3 days, they grow a shell on one side, then they drop. And in another 3 or 4 days, the other side shell grows, and that's where they stay. Sometimes, because the tide is too strong, the spawn is wasted." And this is almost the exact replication of what Neil Bourne had told me. So what William is saying is almost identical. So it's interesting that the scientist was with William, but I've never been able to find any record that he recorded the native names of these places that they were examining and that they were digging.
This is CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Unfortunately, due to time constraints, we're going to interrupt this speech by Judith Williams, author of the book Clam Gardens, about our First Nations peoples. The speech was recorded at the Vancouver Public Library by Thomas Hicks of Necessary Voices. Find out more at necessaryvoices.org. You can download the full speech, 1 hour and 20 minutes long, from the Oceans section of the Radio EcoShock website at www.ecoshock.org. Right now, though, we'll take you to the end of the speech before closing out the Local Brown Bagger show. Here again is BC researcher and author Judith Williams.
Still, it's hard to understand the information gap that arose about clam gardens owned and cultivated in so many coastal areas. And certainly within the territory Boaz recorded, and George Hunt is known to have contributed information about. In Reconstructing Indigenous Resource Management, Reconstructing the History of an Idea, which is the introduction to Keeping It Living by Nancy Turner and Doug Doerr, they tackle the problem of Boaz's lack of published material on Northwest Coast plant cultivation. Their thesis may is the operative word here, apply to other cultivated foodstuffs. They find Boaz's public dismissal of Northwest Coast plant cultivation enigmatic, which is an interesting way of putting it, I guess, and they cite cases in which he acknowledges data on plot location and ownership, that is, plot location food material. However, they argue that Boaz engaged in very little field observation of these practices, and he tended to underplay the practices and testimonies of women or non-elite men who were the primary plant cultivators. They proposed that it was Boaz's intent to undermine the prevailing orthodoxy of the time, which regarded hunter-gatherer societies to be incapable of the sophisticated cultural development associated with agricultural societies. And he was coming from Europe, and he wanted to make his mark, and he disagreed. Boaz presented the cultures of Pacific Northwest as evidence for his argument that hunter-gatherer societies, under favorable conditions, could easily attain the sophistication of agriculturalists without having to cultivate crops. A side effect of Boaz's view was that the hunter-gatherers were considered capable of only the most tentative claims to land ownership. This proved a great convenience to early settlers. A tendency developed amongst anthropologists and archaeologists to overlook evidence that Boaz himself found little use for, since he trained all the other early... He is a father of anthropology, and he trained all the early anthropologists, or most of them, and as a result, evidence of active management and manipulation of natural resources wasn't conserved in the, quote, literature that we couldn't find. That's the reason we couldn't find the literature, because it didn't exist, because nobody wrote this down. That didn't mean, of course, that Native people didn't know all about this. And that fact, combined with the lack of fieldwork that might have uncovered the rock wall terraces, contributed to the professional skepticism amongst archaeologists when John Turner and I independently presented evidence that people had constructed terraces to enhance bivalve cultivation. Now, the clam gardens, in my view, are a coastal treasure for a whole number of reasons. They are unique living artifacts. They are still usable sources of food and exchange items for the local population. This primary mariculture technology of the Pacific Northwest coast should be protected for the descendants of those who created it. I'll just read one little recipe. There's a recipe section because this book is about food, so it had to have recipes. And I'll just quote William Scow. He says, "You know, we barbecue clams, and it's delicious. You lay the clams on top of the fire in the shell. The nectar is embedded right into the body of the clam." Well, thank you very much.
Says yes, and I believe him when we talk about the things I see.